Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Of course, you could get sick any time of the year, but it's more likely that if you come down with a whopper of a cold or a nasty stomach bug, it'll happen now, in winter. And for some people, what begins as minor aches and pains or a small cough can quickly turn into a life-threatening illness. Today in The Exchange, the real story on why we get sick in winter and how to better protect yourself. Also, later in the hour, we explore another type of winter blahs, seasonal affective disorder, defined as depression due to the changing season. Let's get your questions in first on the hows and whys of winter colds, flus, and bugs. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests in studio. Beth Daly is here, Chief of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Control at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Beth, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Also with us, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, Infectious Disease Specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital and a professor at the Geisel School of Medicine. And Dr. Talbot, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Dr. Douglas Phelan, family physician and preventive medicine resident practicing in Concord and Epsom. He's also a public health student at Dartmouth Institute. And Dr. Phelan, good to meet you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks, Laura. Good to be here.
So, Dr. Phelan, what is the real reason people tend to get sick in winter? Do we know? There are lots of theories out there.
There certainly are. Getting sick in the winter is something that we're all used to hearing, right? We're used to hearing about it in the media and seeing it in advertisements on TV for different, you know, over-the-counter remedies and such. And there's a few different things that can contribute to that. In some cases, it's viruses that are more prevalent and more common in the winter. We know that from surveillance data, which I'm sure my colleagues will help get into. A few of those viruses that people may have heard of, things like rhinovirus, is particularly common, as well as the flu, which I'm sure we're going to get to in a little more detail as well. So in addition to things being more common around now, there are also some studies, and this is where things are apparent but not fully apparent, that the cooler temperatures can contribute, right? So there are some studies that I've been through that say immune system cells initiate a more robust defense at lung temperature versus nasal temperature. So some viruses, like the rhinovirus, can replicate better at cooler temperatures, and the weather might affect how you fight it in that case.
Wow, interesting. So this is another myth you're going to have to bust for me, and then we'll bring our other guests in. Just this morning, it's freezing. I said to my younger son, put a hat on or you'll get sick. I'm sure, you know, half of the mothers and fathers in New Hampshire said this morning. Put a hat on or you'll get sick. You'll catch cold. Last time you caught a cold, it turned into bronchitis. That was nasty, blah, blah, blah. Of course, he refused to wear the hat. Does putting a hat on help you defend yourself in the winter?
Well, I would say putting a hat on helps you keep your body temperature doing well. We know that we lose body heat through the head
sure.
a lot. But as far as a direct correlation to prevention of illness, I'm not certain that the evidence is all there for that one.
Okay,
but it's
well,
certainly
not
a bad idea.
Right now. So, what do you think, Dr. Talbot? Why do we tend to, you know, if we're going to get something nasty, chances are good it's going to be this time of year.
Well, that's right. We observe a peak in our common cold and flu viruses in our winter season, surely. And part of it is, as Dr. Phelan mentioned, that the viruses appreciate the colder temperatures. What I've learned is also that it's not only the cold, but it's the dry that accompanies our winter season. And this favors the way that viruses want to transmit in our human biology. So they're able to survive that in an environment longer. They're able to stay suspended in our sneeze droplets longer. And then there's the human biology that's happening. That is, you want to conserve your core temperature, so you constrict your nasal blood vessels, essentially, and this diverts our immunity away from where it needs to be to avoid the introduction of these viruses. So there's so many things going on. It's such an interesting intersection of features of our behavior that is clustering indoors where we're able to transmit one to another more readily, the way the cold affects our own biology and our immune system, and also how it favors the viruses in a lot of cases.
So listening to what you say, Dr. Talbot, it seems like you should crank the heat and turn on a humidifier in every single room in your house? I mean,
jeepers. surely not. And in fact, it's central heating that is particularly effective at drying our environments, yeah, which favors virus transmission. So drying our noses out is a really big risk factor for letting these viruses get in to where they can cause the trouble and the misery of these viral infections.
What are you tracking this time of year, Beth, at Department of Health and Human Services?
So the winter is an important time for transmission of lots of viruses. As Dr. Talbot mentioned, we do see these viruses increase in the winter in part because people tend to congregate, spend more time indoors, coming into contact with one another. So the types of viruses we typically see this time of year are those viruses that are transmitted from one person to another, such as influenza, rhinovirus, as well as some gastrointestinal viruses such as norovirus, which people often refer to as the stomach flu, but it's not really influenza. It's actually a different virus called norovirus that causes diarrhea and vomiting. So there's a number of different viruses that are circulating. Of course, we're here today to focus on influenza, which is certainly a big concern this time of year.
Yeah, and I'd like to actually focus not just on influenza, but all those colds and stomach bugs and why we get them. And also, as you all know, why for some people, you know, a small quote-unquote common cold can turn into something more serious like pneumonia or bronchitis. What do you guys worry most about, Beth, this time of year?
So influenza is of major concern to us just because of the potential for having severe complications such as pneumonia and even death. Unfortunately, it's not an uncommon disease this time of year, and we do see people who become hospitalized and die from their infection. Because it is so common, we don't individually track every case of illness that occurs in our state, but we do look at a number of different data systems that are available to us. For example, monitoring what people are coming into the emergency departments for. We monitor school absenteeism rates. We look at over-the-counter pharmaceutical sales for cough and cold remedies or for thermometers even, just to get a sense of what's going on. And what we have been observing over the last several weeks is increases in what we call influenza-like illness, which could represent colds or other viruses, but is typically also indicative of transmission of influenza in the community. And so we're really concerned about that right now.
That's really interesting, not just what people report to the emergency room or the doctor's office when they're really feeling bad, but just purchases of medicine and thermometers. That's actually really interesting. I'm fascinated by what you said, Dr. Phelan, and you too, Dr. Talbot, about the viruses themselves. And I'd love a little bit more, maybe with you first, Dr. Talbot, just the idea that this weather right now is kind of the perfect storm for these viruses. I mean, you touched on it, but why are they so happy this time of year?
They're happy because we're clustered together. So passing them one to another by our sneezes, by our coughs, by our physical contact with each other and also with our environments, right? And the fact that the cold and especially that dry air we're living in now lets them live longer on the surfaces that we encounter every day. And that, again, they stay suspended well in the air and the environment when they desiccate down, when they dry down to these tiny droplets that are able to just float about, ready to be sucked down by the next unfortunate victim.
So if the air is moist, these viruses are more likely to drop to the floor. When the air is dry, they can kind of circulate better?
Yes, exactly.
Wow, that's
right.
Really interesting.
Yeah, and I was impressed with some preliminary pilot kind of studies that showed that humidifying schools might be a way of decreasing the number of colds, of respiratory viruses that our children are getting. That data hasn't translated to an imperative for everyone to humidify their home, but I think most people do feel more comfortable when they're able to keep their skin and their mucous membranes moist and healthy.
So Dr. Talbot and you too, Dr. Phelan, if this cold weather, as you've so well described, you know, dry, cold, really helps these viruses be active, be circulating, does that mean Americans who live in Southern California or Florida or Mississippi don't get as sick this time of year as we tend to in New England, Dr. Talbot?
So I do believe anywhere in the world, these viruses circulate. So whatever the climate, but we're focused on our temperate climate where we have this cold snap of the winters. But we know, too, that in the tropics, these viruses don't have a seasonality. They circulate year-round and don't have the same kind of peak. And this is in part because the air is very humid. So in contrast, the moist environments allow survival of the virus as well. Like, you know, they're sitting in essentially a culture medium of highly humid environments, it's thought. So the extremes of conditions can be facilitating. But indeed, dry environment is key. So even warm desert environments or dry environments are at risk.
Dr. Phelan?
Yeah, I would also throw in a bit of timely news. So I think this past month, the World Health Organization, you brought up some other climates and areas, came up with its list of the top 10 threats in global health. And two of them are vaccination and influenza. So it's sort of a nexus of what we're talking about. So even though we're feeling it here in the cold weather in New England and across a lot of the United States right now, certainly warmer climates as well are still concerned about this.
So you can still get the flu even if you're living in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Phelan. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
Well, just that I appreciate that WHO report because I expect that people are expecting kind of sexier diseases on that list, yeah? So
Zika or something.
Ebola, yeah, Zika, right. MERS-CoV, whatever. But what do we really suffer with as a species? Yeah, are these annoying 2 to 3 colds a year? And really a life-threatening flu, especially in some vulnerable populations. So I really appreciated that getting flu on that list because we are all braced. We are all expecting pandemic flu to rear its ugly head sometime, likely in our generation. So
wow. All right. Well, let me remind our listeners to join us. Our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, why we tend to get sick in the winter, whether it's a cold or a flu or a stomach bug or something much worse. Many of these illnesses seem to plague us, especially this time of year. We're finding out why, and a little bit later we'll talk about how to better prevent illness and treat yourself if you do get sick. Also, later in our hour, we'll look at what's called seasonal affective disorder. Join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, all of you, since we're talking about the flu, let's go there. And Beth Daly, how good a job do New Hampshire residents do in general in terms of vaccinating themselves against the flu? This has been a big campaign in recent years.
Sure. So that's a great question. Of course, that is the number one recommendation we make for individuals in order to prevent influenza. Typically, in any given flu season, about 60% of our children are getting vaccinated.
60%.
Yes. And that's about what we see nationally in New Hampshire. Because we have a universal purchasing program for vaccines for children, we do tend to have higher vaccination rates in general in New Hampshire, which is really great, but of course they're not where we want them to be. We want them to be up above 90% of children who are getting vaccinated. We do see lower vaccination rates for adults, especially in younger adults age 18 to 49. Only about 26% or so of those individuals are getting vaccinated each year. Although, of course, we make a very strong recommendation for vaccination in people who are over the age of 65, and they do tend to have higher vaccination rates, around the same as children at 60%. So that's great. People are heeding that advice to get vaccinated, but we really want everyone over the age of 6 months to get an influenza vaccine each year. And so it's about 40% for the rest of the adults, and we want it to be much higher than that.
I'm surprised it's as low as it is because it seemed like, I don't know, a month or 6 weeks ago, everywhere I went, you know, you want a flu vaccine? You want a flu vaccine? You know, I brought a kid to the doctor. Would you like a flu vaccine? I went to Rite Aid and picked something up. Would you like a flu vaccine? I said, no, thanks. We already had a vaccine clinic here at work. But Dr. Talbot, why get vaccinated? We often hear that, oh, this year's vaccine, sorry, it really wasn't that effective. So, you know, good luck.
We're in an unusual place with regards to the influenza vaccine, aren't we? We're used to taking on vaccination for a particular disease once in our lifetime. But here it is that we have to do flu each year. And so we approach the same resistances. Nobody really wants to get a needle in their arm, yeah, go out of their way, pay the money, et cetera. And yet this is a wily, promiscuous kind of virus. It shifts and it drifts every single year, and it depends on experts who predict what will be the predominant circulating strain of flu for us each season. So we have a, I think, societal contract to pay attention to that, to do indeed get your flu shot for maximum protection, particularly those who are in a high-risk population.
Well, year after year, we hear that, you know, this year's vaccine was only 30% effective or something. I mean, it yeah. seems like we don't hit it very well. I mean, smallpox vaccines prevent smallpox. So why is it so imperfect?
Well, I think it's a complicated story, you know, and you cannot capture the benefit of flu vaccine in a single number, right? Because there's what we hope for with this vaccine, that it will completely prevent or abort disease, and you can go about your daily life and not be sick at all. But we also hope that it'll ameliorate disease if you do get it, yeah? So I think that it's a pretty great thing if you get a vaccine and it doesn't prevent you necessarily from getting sick, but it prevents you from being hospitalized or dying. That's not nothing.
So it eases the symptoms.
Absolutely.
What do you tell Dr. Phelan, your patients, about the flu and the vaccine especially? I'm surprised to hear Beth tell us that the rates are relatively low, 40% for adults, 60% for kids. That doesn't sound like very much.
Yeah, it's something, unfortunately, that on the front lines we see pretty often, and it's a conversation we have to have with families. People treat the flu vaccine a little differently than they treat some of those other vaccines that are one and done or have great guarantees on or better guarantees on efficacy. So what I normally tell folks is I get it every year. People always ask the question in primary care, what would you tell your family? And I would tell my family to get the flu vaccine, just like I do. It is a chance, and some years a better chance than others, but it is always a chance at protection from this. And it also protects people around you, the concept of herd immunity, that the more people who are getting this, the less it's being passed around and transmitted in these environments, and especially as Dr. Talbot had mentioned, in the winter we're clustering together in close quarters, so there's a higher chance of that happening. So I recommend it's a poke in the arm, and I think there's also a role for those of us in public health and in medicine to sort of show that we're getting it. You know, sometimes we have our little ID badges with a little red dot, but I think there's a role for us to get out in the community, get out on social media and say, we're getting our shot and we recommend it for ourselves and our families.
Why do you think the levels are relatively low that Beth described?
So usually if people are asked to get a few vaccines, especially for kids, the flu vaccine will be one that they'll try to bargain off. You know, if kids are due for two shots or three shots.
Little kids, especially when they're in that cycle. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can say, well, we'll do these two and maybe we'll come back for that other one. That's something we'll often hear. And I think it goes to that mentality again about this is one that is necessary for me to be in school. These shots are necessary for me to be around other folks. These shots have better guarantees at efficacy. And this one I'm not so sure about.
And there is a lot of negative publicity. I remember a couple years ago, there were a lot of headlines about, boy, it didn't even begin to work this year. So I think people get cynical, Dr. Phelan. So how do you sort of talk about that with patients?
I think you first acknowledge it, right? Like what nobody is saying, I think, and nobody should be saying that this is 100% effective. Nobody's saying it's a guarantee. But to say, if we were betting people that your chances are better with the vaccine than without.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and we'll start taking your emails. Your questions and comments are welcome. exchange@nhpr.org. We're answering your questions about why we tend to get sick in the winter. Not just the flu, also the common cold that morphs into other problems sometimes, stomach bugs, why they seem to plague us more this time of year than any other. Join us, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-64 in a moment. Also later in the hour, new information on seasonal affective disorder. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The start of a new year is a great time to evaluate your dreams for the future. Hi, I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Plan Giving for NHPR. including NHPR in your will or state plan, is an inspired way to spell out your hopes and dreams for your community and for your state. It's also a powerful action you can take today to ensure quality public radio programming in New Hampshire is here for generations to come. Email me at salger@nhpr.org to learn more, or go to nhpr.giveplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Colds, flus, bugs, they all seem to plague us this time of year. We're finding out why, also how to better protect yourself. And a little later in the hour, we'll examine what's called seasonal affective disorder. Let's get your questions and comments in now. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Dr. Douglas Phelan, a family physician, preventive medicine resident practicing in Concord and Epsom, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital and a professor at the Geisel School of Medicine, and Beth Daly, chief of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Control at New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. One more time, that number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, just before the break, we talked about the flu and the vaccine and how it isn't always perfect, but you all said that people should get it anyway. Sarah in Concord asks, any chance that the flu mist will be reformulated to be effective? I have a daughter who is afraid of needles, so it would be nice to have options. Sarah, I have been there. I completely understand what you're saying. Beth, do you know about this?
Sure. So there were some studies that came out that left us concerned about whether or not the flu mist, that route of administration for the vaccine, was effective. The data were looking like it was not particularly effective. And so at one point, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is a federal entity, advised us not to use that vaccine for that particular year. Since then, now additional studies have come out, and they are recommending that if someone were going to choose between not being vaccinated and getting the flu mist, they would still recommend using flu mist. In New Hampshire here, we, as I mentioned earlier, we purchase all the vaccines for children in our state, and we are not currently offering that vaccine, so it would be
in
difficult, correct, to get it as a child here in New Hampshire. I'm not sure if pharmacies or other entities are carrying the flu mist for the adult population. But we'd like to see a little bit more data about the efficacy for this vaccine.
Yeah, I remember some disappointed looks when the mist went away. So do you want to jump in on that, Dr. Phelan?
I would definitely echo that. I think if we had the option, it certainly would be something, you know, taking a nasal mist opposed to a shot in the arm. But the evidence we have to go by. And so when the evidence supports that, normally in the primary care setting, we kind of have to go with what's available. And so when it's available, we recommend it. But certainly, you know, needle phobia is a real thing, and it's something we try to work with kids with in a variety of ways.
All right. Thank you for the question, Sarah. Here's another one. This is from Allie in Concord. I've had terrible allergies all my life and recently started allergy injections to reduce my symptoms. I haven't gotten sick as often as I used to, both with allergy symptoms and a seasonal cold. What's the science behind this? Is it just a coincidence? That's really interesting, Allie, and I'm glad you're feeling better. Dr. Talbot, any thoughts on that?
I would certainly say that allergies can be a misery, of course. Yeah, and so I'm glad that things are turning around for you with the treatments you're taking. And I suppose there's some intuitive potential explanation for what's happening for you. And it speaks to the way that our body's secretions, not to get gross here, right, serve as sometimes facilitating for infections. So if you have a lot of stagnant secretions from allergies, it's the potential that it serves as a nidus of growth media, essentially.
Everything's
right?
Staying inside your body.
So I think that that's a plausible explanation. But again, sounds like you're making some important inroads to your health there.
Well, that's great. Thank you for that email. And let's go to the phones. Margaret's calling from Stark. Hi, Margaret. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment about bronchitis. Ever since I was a young child, I'm in my late 50s now, I would get bronchitis every winter and suffer for 6 to 8 weeks with a horrible cough. One day I was in a bookstore and I was talking to a friend about that, and a man was eavesdropping, a holistic practitioner, and he said, you don't get, he says, you get bronchitis once, and then it goes dormant, but he says it's the dry air that brings it back every year. So he said, have yourself a pear and a cup of black tea every day, and you won't get bronchitis.
A pear.
So I've been doing that for 5 years and haven't gotten bronchitis since. And I also see an acupuncturist, so I asked him about it, and he said yes. He says what that does is the pear and the black tea, they don't have to be had together, keep the lungs moist.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, Margaret. And I did want to ask all of you about, you know, other alternatives to treating illness, preventing illness. You know, a lot of people listening probably take some form of vitamin C or zinc or echinacea or elderberry syrup that some people swear by. Dr. Phelan, to you first, but anybody jump in. What are some of the sort of immune boosters that we hear about, and what do we know about how effective they might be?
Right. I think there's a lot to say on a lot of these. Let this be my first chance to say the best thing that I can recommend is washing our hands. Right. So we've talked about how these viruses, these germs are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. And regular hand washing is the best way to keep these that can live. They can live on surfaces for hours away. There was actually going back to a big study on a naval base where they found that if they mandated hand washing to at least 5 times a day, they found over 2 years that upper respiratory illness went down 45%.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so that is a big, primary, easy thing that we can try to do in our daily lives. But then you've got all of these products, right? And so there's different things on different ones. I remember my mom had me take vitamin C as a kid. And the evidence has gone back and forth on vitamin C. There's no evidence right now as of our best, you know, what we call meta-analyses, reviewing all of the studies and ranking them based on how good they are and the bias of the study and such. There's really not a benefit to starting it when you're sick. So if you're sick and you go and you grab some vitamin C, it's probably not doing much. They have found that some people who take it on a daily basis can shorten the duration of their cold by a small amount. And there's some back and forth about whether that's significant, like a quarter of a day, or whether it's actually not significant at all. And I should mention, with vitamin C and all of these things, zinc, echinacea, everything that's acting in our bodies, we tend to think these are supplements, these are vitamins. They have real interactions. They get processed through our body just like medicines get processed through our body. They also interact with medications. So they're not something that should be started or stopped lightly. And it's something I definitely recommend talking with people's medical teams about. But there's certainly more to say about zinc and echinacea and some other things too.
Okay, interesting. I'd love your thoughts too, Dr. Talbot, just broadly on all the various, you know, immune boosters that are out there, whether it's black tea and a pear, which sounds like it's good for you anyway, and some of the other stuff that you can get over the counter, some of which is quite expensive. I mean, you can buy a $50 immunity booster, and who knows if it helps or not.
You're right, of course, and I appreciate Dr. Phelan's comments. There are a lot of things out there. We hope for help in a bottle, absolutely.
Sure, especially if you're feeling lousy.
And I think many of us who are clinicians see our job to look at the data. You know, and that means studies have to be done on these things so we can make a credible recommendation for such. And this is why many of us continue to land back at some of those less easy ways of approaching our health, such as a healthy diet and maintaining a healthy weight and stopping to smoke. Those clearly have a role in keeping us healthy. Yeah. So that's why we probably we'll say that more often to you. Washing your hands, alcohol-based hand rubs, staying away from sick people, not going to work or school when you're sick. Those are the groundwork of health in our community. And some of the other mechanisms that people have found for their own health, I simply can't comment on the anecdotes, frankly. I think there are lots of things we don't understand and have not studied. But I don't have an expertise in them because those studies aren't done.
Well, hand washing for sure, and sleep.
Yes, good one, sure.
I mean, let's just add that to the list. Go ahead, Beth.
And the good news is that those measures that we're discussing now are effective at preventing all types of viruses, influenza, norovirus, the rhinovirus. They just generally can make us healthier in a lot of ways.
Yep. Well, speaking of hand washing, here's an email from Matthew in Henniker. Okay, so Matthew says, I have noticed that you folks in the radio business tend to get sick pretty regularly, as evidenced by husky-voiced newsreaders, extensive absences of hosts, etc. Does NHPR and the radio business generally do anything special to protect its workforce, especially those working with germ-laden microphones? Matthew, thank you so much for the call. every Monday when I come in, I wipe down this whole studio. And during the cold and flu season, I tend to wipe it down pretty regularly, including this morning. So there you go, Matthew. And of course, we do try to wash our hands. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, and I think this is also an interesting point where we can give a plug to our friends in what's called occupational medicine or occupational health. So in a lot of our workplaces, particularly bigger companies and bigger workplaces, there are folks who can help to watch out and know what cleaning products are getting used and know how they work. And they do good work all across the state, so it's good to acknowledge them.
Well, Matthew, I really appreciate the email. And here's two emails I want to read back to back from Kyle and Nancy. Kyle says, I don't ever get the flu shot, and I can't remember the last time I've gotten the flu or gotten really sick. Nancy from Raymond says, I can't ever remember having had the flu all my life. Today I'm told I need the vaccine. Why is that? Beth, I want to turn to you on this. Kyle and Nancy are saying what you hear from a lot of people, which is, I never get the vaccine, and I'm always fine.
So that's great. I'm happy to hear that from their perspectives. What we tend to look at from a public health perspective, though, is overall what's happening in our population. And that's some people will not become infected. They might be practicing all these other prevention measures that we've talked about, or maybe they have a fantastic immune system that's helping to protect them. But we do know that the vaccine is safe and effective at preventing influenza, and it does protect people who become infected from some of these severe consequences like pneumonia and potentially death. So, you know, we need to continue to recommend that all individuals get vaccinated.
Well, and as we talk about, you know, you guys are saying get the vaccine, protect other people. I want to ask you, Dr. Phelan, but anybody jump in. Who do you especially worry about this time of year? I mean, someone with, you know, a regular healthy adult like me, I'm going to get a cold or whatever, and then I'll get over it. But other people will get that cold, and then it will morph into something more serious. So who are you especially keeping track of?
It's a really good question. So when we talk about high risk for the flu, we're typically talking about people who are at high risk for severe flu-related complications. And there's a lot of different ways to slice the population to look at this. One is sort of demographic-wise, right? So we worry about the very young. We worry about children younger than 5, especially younger than 2. We worry about adults over 65.
Is that because their immune systems just aren't as strong?
Yeah, it's a change. It's a change in immune systems on both sides of the age spectrum. Mm-hmm. We also recommend it strongly for pregnant women through 2 weeks postpartum, who are also at a higher risk from different studies for influenza. We worry about folks who live in long-term care facilities and nursing homes. I think part of that goes to the immune system itself. Part of it goes to the environment in which they live. So there's that. We also worry about folks who have different, what we would term comorbidities or conditions that they also have. So especially people with lung conditions like COPD and cystic fibrosis, asthma, things like that, but also people with heart disease, people with weakened immune systems due to other reasons. There's a number of causes, so it's something definitely to go over with your medical team.
Yeah, so Dr. Talbot, I might get a cold, but someone with asthma might get a cold and a lot more.
You're exactly right. And we have an increasing number of persons in our society also who have diabetes. We're recognizing that this serves as a mildly immunocompromising condition as well. We think of immunocompromised conditions like HIV and advanced AIDS and cancer chemotherapies. But we think now of diabetes, which again is so common, as something that should cause people to think twice and three times and go out and get those vaccinations they need, especially flu.
And do a little bit more of the hand washing than maybe the rest of us do. Go ahead, Beth.
Well, while we're talking about high-risk populations, it might be an important time to talk about the role of antiviral medications.
I'd love to talk about that because that seems relatively new in recent years. Yeah, go ahead.
So those people who are at high risk for infection and other people as well, if you do start to develop symptoms of what could be influenza, which would be the fever and cough or sore throat, it would make sense for you to consult your healthcare provider early on in illness to talk about whether or not an antiviral medication would be appropriate for you, especially for people with who are at high risk for influenza. The antiviral medication can help prevent some of these severe complications.
So you're going to get the flu, but it might not be as severe, and then you don't end up in the hospital with pneumonia or something more serious. Anybody else want to jump in on that? It seems to me that these are relatively new, that people just started offering them in the last 4 or 5 years. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
Indeed,
Dr. Talbot? Yeah.
They have been around longer.
Okay.
But I do think we're recognizing their value. We have more and more data coming in, right, that more studies showing that people are more likely to survive flu and have shorter hospitalizations or no hospitalizations. So we especially look to use those in outbreaks to try to halt that, such as at long-term care facilities or school settings. But we also want clinicians to think of it sooner if they're seeing one of these persons who's vulnerable for a bad outcome if they do have flu.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. And Alex is in Francistown. Hi, Alex. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you so much. I was curious about your thoughts on how diet ties in with overall health and really just general general happiness and does it, how much someone really gets involved in a certain sickness or how much someone certainly would get tied in with, like, I hear about all the flu shots and all that, but I think that a diet might even be able to kind of make the need for those certain flu shots to be needed. But correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just curious on your
sure.
thoughts.
Sure. Well, Alex, you can't understate the importance of diet and overall health. So, Dr. Phelan, do you want to jump in on that?
Sure. No, I think you're exactly right. The importance of diet in all health conditions, so any number, but all health conditions, is definitely important. I'm not an expert in what we'd call functional medicine or areas where you start really honing in on different dietary components. We've already talked about vitamin C a little bit, yeah, and we know that that can come through in diets as well as tablets and chews and things like
sure.
that. And we've heard, which was news to me, about the pears.
pears and black tea.
So certainly diet plays a role, and we wouldn't want to downplay it. But I think as the caller, I think I heard towards the tail end there said, it's not a substitute for these other things, but it certainly can help, and I would definitely support that.
Well, and Brianna sent us an email from Amherst. I'm wondering why some people get significantly sicker than others. My son and I will get a cold, but for my husband and his whole family, it almost always progresses to bronchitis, sinus infection, upper respiratory infection. I have wondered about this too, Brianna. Anybody want to jump in on that? Some people just seem to get everything that comes down the pike.
I've certainly heard that as well in my
yeah.
practice. I just want to say I think that the immune system, which sounds very simply encapsulated in those two words,
right.
is incredibly complicated, right? I mean, that there are chemicals, there's proteins, there's stimulation of different systems that happen, there's different cell types, many different cell types. So a person's genetic makeup, their environment, their behaviors, all of that influences how well their immune system works. So I think that there's just a complexity that you're observing, and everyone typically observes in their community about people who seem to do better and worse with infections.
Well, it's an interesting question, Brianna, one I have wondered as well. Again, I have two kids. One seems to get everything. One seems to get nothing. So I hear you. All of you, this has been really interesting. We could have talked a lot longer, but I want to thank everybody for coming in. Beth, it was good to see you. See you again.
Thank you so much.
That's Beth Daly, Chief of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Control at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Talbot, thank you for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Elizabeth Talbot. She is an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital and a professor at the Geisel School of Medicine. And Dr. Phelan, we'll talk to you again. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Laura. Good to be here.
That's Dr. Douglas Phelan. He's a family physician and preventive medicine resident practicing in Concord and Epsom. Now, coming up, we will turn to another subject that you're probably hearing about this time of year. We'll look at seasonal affective disorder, what it is, how to treat it, some of the myths around it. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange with host Peter Biello. Right now, we look at what's called seasonal affective disorder. And let's get your questions in on this. There's a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions around this. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. Or call in 1-800-892-6477. Again, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us now from Vermont is Kelly Rowan. She's an expert on seasonal affective disorder and a professor of psychological science at the University of Vermont. And Professor Rowan, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Good morning. You're welcome.
So what is seasonal affective disorder?
Seasonal affective disorder, I'm just going to refer to it as SAD, is a subtype of clinical depression. And the only thing that makes it different from garden variety depression that does not follow a seasonal pattern is that seasonal affective disorder does follow a seasonal pattern, where we have the depressive symptoms in effect during certain seasons, and then they fully resolve or go away during the opposite season.
And it's interesting.
Overwhelmingly, the most common presentation is the winter type SAD, where people are depressed in the fall and the winter months, and then they go back to their normal functioning in the spring and the summer months.
Well, and that's really interesting. I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think a lot of people think of seasonal affective disorder or SAD as just a wintertime thing. You're saying mostly, but not entirely. So just fill us in a little bit more there.
It looks like a minority of people who experience SAD have the summer pattern, where they have the depression in the summer months and they feel their best in the winter. This is really a very rare presentation. Overwhelmingly, the more common presentation is the winter type. So when people refer to SAD, you can more or less assume that they're talking about the winter type.
Is this considered, Professor Rowan, a medical condition?
It's considered a psychiatric disorder in the same way that major depressive disorder, schizophrenia, eating disorders such as bulimia and anorexia are considered mental health problems.
How long have doctors been looking at this, Professor Rowan? For the past 20 years, 30 years, 100 years? How long have people taken this seriously?
Well, the very first research on this as a form of depression was conducted in the early 1980s at the National Institute of Mental Health. The term seasonal affective disorder was coined in a paper that was published in 1984 by a psychiatrist by the name of Norman Rosenthal, who was a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, originally from South Africa, and found when he made the move from South Africa to Bethesda, Maryland, he developed a depression in the winter that he'd not previously experienced, so began to put out ads in the Washington Post, "Is there anyone else out there who's noticed that they have this pattern of depression in the fall and the winter?" And the phone rang off the wall for a few weeks. Thousands of people called in. And that's how they started doing the research to get a handle on what are the symptoms, how prevalent is this, and how can we treat it.
That's really interesting. So not that long ago, people started talking more seriously about this. Still today, I wonder what you think, Professor Rowan. Do some people just kind of blow this off? You know, just go outside, go for a walk in the snow, you'll feel better.
Well, I think, like most things, seasonal affective disorder, it happens on a continuum. So when we're talking about seasonal affective disorder, we're at the extreme. We're talking about clinical depression. But most people at a high latitude are going to have some symptoms of seasonality, maybe some mild changes in energy, sleep, food preferences, minor weight fluctuations. So it's something everybody can relate to. And certainly something that people like to talk about around the water cooler. It's kind of out on the street that this is a phenomenon. People can relate to it. And probably for the average person at a high latitude, there are certain things within their control that they can do, like the things you just mentioned, getting outside more, staying active, and so on. But people that really suffer from the full-blown clinical depression are probably going to require some kind of professional intervention in order to help their symptoms to improve.
All right. Well, we've actually got a couple emails already in, Professor Rowan. And I want to remind people that, again, for the next 10 minutes or so, we're exploring seasonal affective disorder. And you can join us with your questions, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. A couple questions I'd love to present to you, Professor Rowan. Christopher in Manchester says, "We often hear that New Hampshire has one of the highest rates of alcoholism and other substance use disorders in the country." Christopher asks, "Is there a correlation between SAD and these rates of addiction or self-medication in our state and other northern climates?" Christopher, it's a great question. What do you think, Professor Rowan?
That is a great question. So like most mental health problems, SAD is highly comorbid with other mental health problems. The most common comorbidity or co-occurring mental health problem is anxiety disorders. We see a lot of anxiety disorders in people who suffer from SAD. In addition, as this question references, substance use. And we see it a lot as a form of coping in people who are really struggling during the winter months with their depression, isolating themselves and turning to substances to try to improve their mood. Of course, we know it's not a very effective coping mechanism for improving mood, but we suspect that's what's going on as a form of self-medication.
So comorbidity means two problems happening at the same time, two or more,
exactly.
Or three. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly, a comorbidity. I know it sounds like a terrifying word,
yeah.
But it means at least another mental health problem in the picture above and beyond whatever the primary problem is.
Here's another great email that came in from someone who says, can food and exercise really help SAD? Every year, this person says, I am terrified when fall begins, as I know SAD will be right behind it. It's like a light switch goes off. Have tried many different meds. Ideas, this person says. Also, this person says, how do you deal with this when you're trying to work a full-time job? There's a lot of stigma. And we definitely talked about that, Professor Rowan. You know, people saying, hey, just, you know, go outside and take a walk.
Yeah.
You'll feel better. But what about treatments such as food and exercise?
Yeah, so there are three treatments for SAD with a good evidence base to suggest that they're effective in randomized clinical trials. One is light therapy, which involves exposure to bright artificial light on a daily basis. There are a number of products on the market in terms of light therapy devices. What we test in research studies and what seems to be the most effective is 10,000 lux, which is the same intensity of light that comes from the sky at sunrise. Full spectrum or cool white fluorescent lights set behind a shield that will block out the ultraviolet rays. Those are not necessary for antidepressant benefits and just run the risk of burning skin or worse yet, retinas. So
yikes.
We get rid of those altogether. In my research studies, the starting dose for light therapy is first thing in the morning upon waking. And then we have to play a bit of a trial error game to get the dose just right for the individual. There's no one-size-fits-all prescription for light therapy in terms of how many minutes per day does the individual need to use it and exactly what time or times of day in order to benefit. So I do recommend if people are out there listening and they're considering pursuing light therapy to get started under the supervision of a provider who has a background in what we call chronotherapeutics, a basic understanding of the relationship between circadian rhythms and mental health. Just because you can walk into Costco and walk out with a happy light doesn't mean that you should. I think of these as medical devices, and there's the potential to shift your sleep around in unpleasant ways, create insomnia. There are side effects, rare but serious side effects, include increased suicidal thoughts, as well as very elevated mood states that we usually associate with bipolar disorders, mania, hypomania.
Wow, so approach with caution.
Therapy, one very strong, empirically supported treatment, lots of research from around the world to support its efficacy. The second, as the caller had mentioned, antidepressant medications, the same ones that are used to treat depression, such as the selective serotonergic reuptake inhibitors, the SSRIs, drugs like Prozac, for example. There was a large study in Canada to support that fluoxetine is more effective than a sugar pill, a placebo, in treating SAD. And the one drug that's FDA approved in this country specifically for the prevention of seasonal affective disorder is Wellbutrin extended release, with the idea that you should start taking it ahead of the symptoms in the late summer to try to ward off an episode altogether.
Well, I wanted to ask
and
you about...
And the last
yeah,
option
go ahead, sorry.
In terms of effective treatments is a talk therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy. This is where most of my research has focused. And it tries to get people to learn more effective coping strategies as the seasons are changing. Specifically new ways of responding to seasonal changes in terms of healthier thinking styles and being more proactive in terms of the things that we do to try to cope and ideally prevent an episode before it starts.
Well, a bunch of questions just based on your response to that email. And I want to thank that person and good luck to them. It sounds like they're struggling. First of all, light therapy. There's a couple more things we should just unpack here. So it sounds like, as you said, don't just walk into Costco and buy a light, a happy light, and walk out. But how do you know what is the right kind of light and what isn't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the research on light therapy is pretty consistent in terms of what we view to be the standard in the field, the devices that have been tested in clinical trials and have shown efficacy. The intensity is 10,000 lux. The spectrum is a cool white fluorescent light with a UV shield. You do not want those ultraviolet rays coming through because that runs the risk of a sunburn or burning the retina. So we certainly don't want to experience that. So in terms of the specs, I mean, that's what someone should look for in terms of a light therapy product that would be like those that have been shown to be efficacious in clinical trials. The ones that are in my lab are about 2 feet by 3 feet in dimension. So this is a
that's
large
big.
Unit.
Yeah.
The idea is that with a unit of that size, if you're within 18 inches and facing it, you're going to get the full dose, the 10,000 lux of light to your retina. Whereas these little ones, it's a real cottage industry, light therapy. It's not FDA regulated. So there's a lot of stuff on the market that we don't know whether it's efficacious because it hasn't been tested in
right.
clinical trials.
Just but buying it off Amazon.
Tiny devices that I've seen, I sort of doubt that they would be efficacious because it seems to me very minor movements of the head would be enough where the full 10,000 lux of light would no longer be reaching the retina. Whereas these gigantic boxes that we use in my research studies, you couldn't get away from it if you're within 18 inches of, you're going to get the full 10,000 lux to your retina.
So here's another question for you then, based on that. And I really appreciate you honing in on the point that, you know, don't just buy it off Amazon or at Costco and say, you know, bing, bang, boom, I'm cured. You said do it under, you know, supervision with somebody who knows what they're doing, right kind of light, right kind of exposure for you. I think the word you used was chronotherapeutics. But as you know, Dr. Roney, a lot of people don't have great insurance. Maybe they don't have a primary care physician, or maybe they have a primary care physician, but they certainly don't have access to, you know, mental health care or even a regular therapist, never mind a specialized chronotherapist. How do people, you know, just regular people living in rural New Hampshire who may not have great health coverage access this possible treatment?
Right. Well, I always say start with the primary care provider. Some primary care providers are comfortable supervising light therapy and others are not. So I think you have to ask your doctor and hope that they will be truthful in terms of their scope of competence if this is something that they feel comfortable working with you to get the prescription, monitoring the side effects. If not, the primary care should be a good referral source in terms of identifying some places in the community that may have, for example, sliding fee scales and be willing to work with patients who have a variety of means in terms of what they can afford. I live in Vermont, so I would know within Burlington, for example, where to refer people. I can't speak to New Hampshire, but usually the primary care providers are in the know in terms of helping people navigate that system and to find affordable services. With light therapy, it doesn't actually take that long to figure this out. It's a few weeks of kind of trial and error to figure out exactly how many minutes a day and exactly what time or times of day do we need in order to get an improvement and to minimize those side effects and those sleep disturbances that can result as a side effect. Because light therapy is shifting circadian rhythms around, and it can impact your sleep cycle.
What do you know, Professor Rowan, about who tends to get this seasonal affective disorder more than others? Do young people get it more than older people? Do men get it more than women? Are there differences in race or ethnicity? Or is this widely experienced?
So in the surveillance data where we tried to get a random population sample and get a handle on how prevalent a mental health problem is. And these studies on SAD, overwhelmingly women are more represented than men. The gender difference in non-seasonal depression is 2 to 1, 2 depressed women to every 1 depressed man. In seasonal affective disorder, it's even more unbalanced. It's at least 3 to 1, if not 4 to 1. So that's one thing that's been consistently replicated across all the survey studies. The other thing that comes out is younger people in the range of 20s to 30s. When we're just looking at, you know, overall population prevalence, we find the most cases of SAD in that demographic of younger adults. What we haven't done, unfortunately, is to kind of follow people over time. So, you know, those 20 and 30-year-olds that we're catching that have this, I wonder as they age, do they continue to have it, or do they perhaps learn to adapt to their symptoms
and learn
to tolerate them and cope better, and maybe they improve over time? We don't know. Again, it's a young disorder. We've only been studying this since the 1980s.
Right. So what do we know about SAD, Professor Rowan, in Nordic countries where the days are also really short in winter? You know, Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Norway?
Yeah. So in the United States, we see this really nice correlation with latitude. The further away from the equator you get, the more cases you find. In Sarasota, Florida, it's about 1%. In Nashua, New Hampshire, it's 9.9%.
Wow.
In Washington, D.C., it's in the range of 5 to 6%. So what's interesting, the Nordic countries, in particular Iceland, has an unusually low prevalence of seasonal affective disorder than what you would expect based purely on their latitude. It's only about 3% of Icelandic individuals that seem to develop the symptoms, and you would expect them to be more in the range of 9 to 10%.
Wow.
Based purely on their latitude. So looking inward on this, the people that conducted the research hypothesized that population selection may have happened in Iceland.
Okay, so the people who were there, yeah. And Professor Rowan, I have to cut you off. We could talk a lot longer. This has been really interesting, and I really appreciate you being with us this morning.
My pleasure.
That's Kelly Rowan. She's a professor of psychological science at the University of Vermont, and this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.